work session on House Bill 3385. Council, we have a series of amendments.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. If you recall, House Bill 3385 is a revision of the laws dealing with planned unit developments, condominiums, housing developments. And we have two sets of amendments before us. We have the dash A7s, which are dealing with technical corrections to the bill that have been proposed by both LC and the proponents of the bill. And I see some of the proponents here in the audience if they wish to testify on what those are, although we heard much of the testimony on those corrections last time. The amendments were just in draft form and had not been fully prepared. If you look in your file, I believe that there was a engrossed copy of the dash A6 amendments that you should have, and the dash A7 should be largely the same. Then the dash A8 amendments are an emergency clause. As I understand it, they're from the committee. The reason for the emergency clause is that there's one provision of the bill which addresses the situation where condominiums are on leased property. That essentially, as I understand it right now, to turn the lease into a fee simple, you would have to get all the condominium owners to agree. That's obviously very difficult, especially in some of the larger communities. And this technical fix would allow the fee simple to apply to each of the individual condominiums. And so slowly over time, those condominiums could turn from leaseholds into fee simples, which just means that they now own the property that they're sitting on, and that would allow them to get financing. It's my understanding that without the emergency clause, some of these leasehold condominiums will not be able to get financing until the bill becomes effective.
All right. Do the proponents need to talk to the amendments, or you're fine with them? Okay. All right. We're in a work session, 3385. Now, you said something about a dash 6 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I recall from the last meeting, there was a dash A6, and that had been hand engrossed to reflect what the dash A7s are going to look like. The dash A7s are the updated, corrected amendment.
All right. So we don't need the dash.
We don't need the dash A6.
All right.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Burdick.
I would move the dash A7 amendments to House Bill 3385.
All right,
and the dash
A8
amendments.
All right, Senator Burdick moves both the A7 and A8 amendments to House Bill 3385. A discussion on the motion. Is there any objection to the motion? If not, the motion passes. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3385 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Burdick moves House Bill 3385 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is any discussion? Any objections to the motion? No objection. Motion passes. Thank you very much. I appreciate all your work on this bill.
Did we pass the dash leave too?
Yes, we did the motion.
Oh.
We did them at the same time.
Combined motion. It's early.
Yeah. I didn't have my walk.
All right. Senator Burdick's all right. All right. Let's see. Let's go now to work session. I'll carry it on Senate Bill 356. And is Senator Corcoran, you are here. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tony Corcoran, Senate District 4. I bring the long-awaited amendments to Senate Bill 356 and attempting to satisfy the concerns of Senator Brown and others with regard to certification. I'll just point out that the only change in the dash 2s have to do with line 13 and 14. Oh, no. Yes, line 13 and 14, basically, which provides for certification for use of the voice stress analyzer by the agency that employs the officer. And the reason we did that, Mr. Chair, as we've discussed before, is that the companies that provide these voice stress analyzers have different protocols for training. So it was very difficult to put this under the umbrella of DPSST or another organization. So what we attempted to do in the amendments was provide the certification by the law enforcement agency that was utilizing the analyzer.
All right. The gentleman to your right. I know you've met.
Matt Keeble with the Lane County Sheriff's Department, the Criminal Investigation Section. And the only other addition I wanted to point out, too, is that the amendment is this applies to use by police officers only, so it's not open to just any civilian usage. The exception allows for the use by law enforcement only investigative purposes, and it doesn't open it up to civilian use.
All right. Great. Senator Brady.
Do you see any logistical problems in the certification responsibility that you get under this amendment? I mean, how would you go about certifying?
Each department, and I'm sorry, Senator Brady, Chairman, each department, as with our department, we have a training section, and there's a minimum training requirement based on the instrument itself. It'd be the responsibility of the department to make sure that their officers within the department meet that minimum training qualification. So I don't see that there would be a logistical problem at all. It'd be, the logistics would be up to the individual department to make sure they comply.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Is there a book somewhere or a class or, you know, how, where do you get the information for the training?
There's different devices that are available. There's a specific training with each device. I do have a copy of the training requirements for one of the specific devices. If the committee would like a copy of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Does the training, I mean, is there any way of testing whether your training is producing more reliable results?
Probably not more than a polygraph. Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I would submit that probably that would be a retrospective analysis. You'd have to look at the success of polygraph and these devices over time to look at the results of them. You know, as we've said, each company that produces these devices has their own training protocol, and you know, in the case of most law enforcement agencies that would even utilize this, they have their own training departments and their own protocols for how they put a training in place.
Mr. Chair, I think this came up in the first hearing, but how does the accuracy of these machines compare to the polygraph?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I did send a follow-up letter to the committee after the original hearing. And in that there was some discussion by somebody, a private polygrapher who discussed the Department of Defense study where the voice stress analyzer only performed at a rate of 49%. What he failed to mention was in the same type of test that the polygraph only performed at 53%. The problem that there is that these tests are done without any jeopardy. If I were to ask you if you were wearing a blue jacket and you were being deceptive about that, what's the risk? What's the jeopardy to you? So there has to be some sort of risk of jeopardy to you for the test to be more accurate. I have spoken with several polygraphers, and in particularly an officer down in California in, I forget the department, who is both a polygrapher and voice stress analyzer examiner, and he did his own informal testing where he did both polygraph exams and voice stress analyzer exams and received almost identical results. I don't know if that answers your question.
All right, John.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. The association very strongly supports passage of Senate Bill 356. You have letters in your file to that effect. You have letters from the police chief of Kaiser, Oregon as well. Oregon is one of only seven jurisdictions where law enforcement cannot use these devices. So it should put, I think, the Senate at ease to know that in most jurisdictions, in the United States, these devices are currently being used and being used successfully. They are not admissible in court. They are an investigation tool that law enforcement needs to be able to use. So we'd recommend the bill with the dash two amendments. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, John. So work session. I have a request from Kelly Sky to allow James Wygand, who's the liquor for the talk, to us. I'll allow that briefly, very briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good night.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is James Wygand. I'm a polygraph examiner. I've been for 27 years. I'm a member of the Polygraph Licensing Advisory Committee, which is the group that licenses examiners in the state of Oregon. And I was an instructor at the polygraph school at Western Oregon University at Monmouth, where we trained examiners for the Oregon State Police and for most other police agencies in the state of Oregon. I'll be very brief. There's only a few things I'd like to say. First of all, voice stress analysis has been around for about 40 years. It is not new technology, which is why it's covered in a statute that you're looking at that's 30 years old. In that 40 years, the industry has had plenty of opportunity to produce even one study that shows that, in fact, accuracy is better than chance determination, and they have never been able to do that. There have been lots of studies on voice stress, many of them done by the Department of Defense. There have been lots of studies on polygraph. We have a pretty good idea how accurate polygraph is. We know that it runs in the range of about 90% to 95%. We know from the research that's been done on voice stress that the accuracy runs at about 50%, which is the same as flipping a coin. Generally, the people who propose these things are supported by the manufacturers, and the manufacturers like to rely on anecdote and testimonial. And very briefly, I'll give you two stories about voice stress analysis that are pretty convincing. First of all, I'd also like to refute two remarks that were made in the previous testimony. One is that most agencies in the United States use voice stress analysis. That is not correct. And let me just move on specifically to these two stories of voice stress. One of them comes out of Henderson, Nevada. The other comes out of Southern California. They're both well-known cases. The Henderson, Nevada case is a probation officer who was a suspect in a rape case. He went into the police department to take a voice stress test, expecting that it was going to exonerate him. He flunked the test. They considered him a viable suspect. They did a DNA analysis. It did not match his DNA, so the DNA excluded him. Based on the voice stress analysis, they concluded that this guy must have then been in some kind of accessory role as a lookout, and charged him with that. They took the case to court based on voice stress analysis, and the judge threw it out. The other case, more notorious, is the Michael Crow case. He was a 14-year-old boy who was suspected of murdering his 12-year-old sister. He was subjected to many hours of interrogation, which included a voice stress test. He was told that he flunked the voice stress test. After approximately 11 hours of interrogation, he finally sort of confessed that he had murdered his sister by saying, "I must have done it, but I just don't remember it." Eventually, it was determined that, in fact, there was DNA analysis that matched the homeless person who was in the area, and all charges and suspicion were removed from the 14-year-old brother of the deceased victim. And the homeless person was arrested and is now awaiting trial. What happens with voice stress analysis is that the people who sell it as being perfect, highly accurate, maybe 100%, and they instill in the people who buy it a high level of confidence that can cause them to make terrible mistakes. And I've just illustrated two of them for you. People talk about this as being a tool that the police use. I think it can be extremely misleading. What it can do is lead people off in the wrong direction, where they become suspicious of somebody who's not a genuine suspect, or alternatively, they can release somebody who is a genuine suspect, but because they're looking at test results that are not right, and they say that this person was telling the truth. I think that's about
it. Let me ask you a couple of questions. Are you familiar with any polygraphers that are bad polygraphers?
Bad polygraphers. Well, I can tell you
they wouldn't trust their interpretation of the data.
I wouldn't say that. I can tell you that as a member of the licensing committee, we have refused to license just in the past year one individual. We have brought another individual up for consideration of revocation of a license. And last year, we got a polygraph examiner who had a license to turn it in, to resign his license. So,
well, Mr. Weigand, let me explain. I've been a policeman for 27 years, and I am familiar with a number of polygraphers, particularly Glenda Lutweiler, who works at the Portland Police Bureau. And I know for a fact that there are polygraphers out there that she does not trust and does not believe do a good job. And in fact, wouldn't confirm their work.
Certainly.
They're not reliable individuals.
I wouldn't say not reliable, but it's like with doctors and lawyers. Some are better than others. It's like any profession.
I'll accept that. All right. Is that it?
That's all I have, unless anybody has a question.
I don't think so.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rago.
I guess I'm trying to review in my brain what happened in the first hearing and what brings us here, but I'm kind of curious why you didn't testify at the first hearing and why you're here now.
Yeah, that's a good question. This really caught us unawares.
Mr. Chair, I was just pointing out to Senator Ringo that Mr. Weigand submitted a letter on March 12th that's in my file.
Right. I wrote that I wasn't here. Okay. And I really felt that this wouldn't get this far. I don't know that much about the legislative process. I'm just an average citizen, and I sort of assumed that this thing would take care of itself, and I'm surprised that it's gotten this far. And
thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We're in work session.
Sure.
Senator Ringo.
Just a comment. I mean, I voted for this before, and I look at it as, it's only an investigative tool, and it's not going to be used in court, and maybe if the local law enforcement organization thinks it's a useful tool, we ought to at least allow them to have that opportunity. And I guess I'm kind of changing just because if this really is no better than chance, then I don't know why we should authorize it or approve it its use. You know. So I just am expressing my ambivalence on this. But
right. And I think that's understandable, but I think had the other side had an opportunity to bring in the results of bad polygrapher work. Or bad investigations. I can point to a lot of the bad investigations, just bad interpretation of data and factual circumstances that investigators have screwed up because they're looking down the wrong road and they refuse to look, you know, in other directions. So,
Mr. Chair, I think you can always take a valid tool and misuse it and reach the wrong result, but that's different than using an invalid tool.
All right. Senator Burdick.
Yeah, I have some of the same concerns because of the percentage, and even in the best case, I certainly support the amendment because at least it provides a method for at least having some kind of oversight over the use of the device. But I'm kind of losing interest in this as well.
Well.
I just have a question. Maybe Senator Corcoran has the answer to it. In my file, I have a series of emails and letters from Hadley McCann, a retired FBI agent, and apparently the conversation was between Hadley and Senator Brown, and I suspect that these amendments are as a result of that conversation, Senator Corcoran.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes, these amendments are basically a result of Senator Brown's concerns we had this bill on the floor, and Senator Brown expressed her concern about licensure. We had a discussion about the difficulty of trying to do it under one umbrella like DPSSD because of the different protocols that the companies had. So essentially what we the result we came to was that if a law enforcement agency decides to use this as a tool, then it is the responsibility of the agency head to adopt the licensure for that particular voice stress analyzer.
So that person's objections have been met. Mr. Wygant wrote again to my office on May 5th on some emails. So Mr. Wygant has been pretty aggressive about making sure that we know his point of view. And again, on April 22, I'm just kind of seeing this like a fight between the polygraphers and the voice stress analyzer people. I'm kind of feeling like there are some protections here because it's only used as an investigative tool. The testimony we had, Senator Corker, I don't know if you remember this, but in a letter, well, I think it was Matt Keitel, indicated that you could use this. It's a letter from Sheriff Clements in Eugene. You can use this when someone is on drugs or pregnant. Which you can't, if you've recently used drugs or you're pregnant, they can't use a polygraph. So this provides an extra opportunity to interrogate someone.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I mean, I think one thing you need to keep in mind about this is that we're losing our polygraphers. I mean, Russ Berger, the battalion officer for the Springfield Office of the State Police, told me that he doesn't have access to polygraphers. And so, you know, to have a tool that's a month or 2 months removed in a criminal investigation, I think really limits the ability of the law enforcement agency to carry out their work. And a lot of it may be eliminating, folks that aren't involved. And to not have this available because we're shrinking down the budgets, you know, in law enforcement, and then to disallow another alternative tool that basically even the U.S. Defense Department says has the same level of accuracy as polygraphy seems to me to be the wrong direction to go if we're trying to assist law enforcement and, you know, trying to prosecute the crimes that they're going after.
All right, Senator.
Yeah, well,
I've never been so glad to see you, Senator Ferrielli.
What I'm trying to find here is, you know, maybe I don't like polygraphy either, but what I'm trying to find here is that some evidence in my file where when people are properly trained, well trained with these machines, that they will produce some results better than chance, better than 50%. That's what I'm trying to look for.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I mean, I'd submit, Senator Burdick, you and I don't know squat about investigative techniques in law enforcement. And, you know, as citizen legislators, we're trying to make the best call to allow the people that do work for us in law enforcement to give it their best shot. And so, you know, we didn't come prepared to do an in-depth analysis of polygraphy or voice stress analysis. This bill is before you because my sheriff and Sergeant Keitel have had exposure to this tool and feel that it would be an asset to them. And we're also facing the lack of polygraphists from the state to supply them when they're doing a criminal investigation.
Yeah, and I understand that, and I understand the cost concerns and that, you know, the ability to do business, but if you get the same result by flipping a coin,
hang on a second. That's conjecture at best. We don't have any documents that say that. We've got polygraphers who are saying that, but we don't have any research or studies that say that. In fact, the one analysis that I saw was from the Department of Defense that showed there was roughly 3 percentage points difference between, and Mr. Wygant's testimony that it's 98% accurate with respect to polygraph is news to me. It's a lot of news to me. So I don't know. To me, this reminds me of health policy committee where you're fighting between the nurses and nurse practitioners and, you know, the chiropractors and every other practitioner out there. And it looks to me more like a turf battle than anything else.
Mr. Chair, I can amend this to have nurse practitioners be the only ones to administer this if you'd like that.
I'd like an amendment to get rid of polygraphs too. I'm very concerned about the percent, and I do have this one piece of information for the Department of Defense that shows the polygraph had 53% and the voice stress analyzer had 49%, which is what a little bit less than chance. I don't know.
Yeah.
Those are non-jeopardy, Mr. Chair. Senator Burdick, as Sergeant Keitel pointed out, doing it based on those results, you'd have to look at the fact that those are non-jeopardy situations.
No, that's a good point.
Yes, Senator Rico.
Could you or somebody refresh me where this DOD study is? Was that submitted to us?
I received a copy of it, although I can't seem to find it on file right now. So.
Okay. But it indicated there's only a 3% difference.
Right. I think somebody's got a copy here.
Yeah.
I
just have my hands.
Well.
Yeah.
I'll sneak away now.
No,
are you done with me?
No, we're not done with you.
No, you did this, Senator Corcoran.
I did it. I'm guilty.
Okay.
Oh.
Get this boy. Get a
lawyer
guy.
Well, are his lips moving, Mr. Chairman?
I'm not a lawyer, Senator Farrielli.
All right. Senator Ringo moves the adoption of the A2 amendment to Senate Bill 356. Discussion. Any objections? Motion passes.
Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I move Senate Bill 356 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendations.
Senator Ringo moves Senate Bill 356 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Corcoran, I appreciate your willingness to work on this thing, and it's unfortunate that you've got caught between the number of individuals who disagree professionally, but I think it's useful. Okay, Senator Burdick objects. Any other objections? If not, motion passes. Senator Corcoran, this is your puppy.
Thank you, sir.
All right, now for fun. And excitement relevant to. Let's see, should we do the Social Security one or the Uniform Armed Regular? All right. 2279.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2279, if you recall, was a bar bill dealing with enactment of the Uniform Arbitration Act. This is the revised act. It has certain updated procedures. We had testimony on this bill quite a while ago, and in the meantime, you will see quite a stack of amendments before you on this bill. Let me go through them one by one. First of all, the -A6 amendments, as I understand it, are the amendments from the proponents. They clarify an issue with respect to how an appeal can be taken from an arbitration. The -A7 amendments and the -A10 amendments, I believe, are from Senator Ringo, and I'll allow him to talk on those if I am correct. And then the -A9 amendments were drafted by the committee. Essentially, what they require is that in medical malpractice cases, they require the parties to go to some form of alternative dispute resolution within 270 days of the date that the complaint was filed. Right now in Multnomah County, which is where I practice the most, Multnomah County has a mandatory ADR requirement that requires all cases to participate in some form of alternative dispute resolution within 270 days of the date the case is filed. That can be mediation, a court-sponsored settlement conference, non-binding arbitration, or anything else that is third-party mediated. And that's the important thing here, is that there is a third party involved in the case who gives his or her evaluation of the case to the individual attorneys and the parties. So they can decide whether or not to settle. They don't obviously have to settle, but they have to participate in the process. This will require, in all medical malpractice cases, up to, I think maybe, up all medical malpractice cases, there's no dollar limit, that they participate in some form of mediation. It was my understanding that some of the folks who would be involved requested that it be non-mandatory, so that they could participate if they wanted to, but they didn't have to. And I think it was my feeling with the direction of the chairman that we didn't need to do an amendment in that case. All these people can already do whatever alternative dispute resolution they want to do. This would obviously force the parties to have a third party evaluate their case just so they could have that information to see if they wanted to settle. So that's the A9s. And then the A11s resolve conflicts between this bill and another bill.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Bruce.
The question, where did you say the A9s came from?
They were at the direction of the chairman.
Committee.
Well,
they came
from
chair.
The committee.
And they're here for discussion purposes. Frankly, I'm not vested one way or the other in whether we do or don't do it. It was suggested that that might be an alternative that would help resolve some of the now cases, and some jurisdictions do this. So I've had contact and conversations with the bar and other individuals. And if the jury is out, I think, in some instances, whether this works or it's becoming more of a hindrance, Senator Ringo might have some opinions about it or not. I think nobody really knows at this juncture whether it helps or it hurts. But I think there's a general premise that some kind of arbitration tends to help resolve cases. And this legislature has traditionally, since the days of the Sidley's Act, moved towards arbitration in many cases. So.
If I could add, Mr. Chairman,
sure.
Currently in Multnomah County, this is a requirement for all cases. So there might be a very few exceptions, but it's my understanding, although I don't practice medical malpractice litigation, but the majority of the cases are going to be filed in Multnomah County. That's where OHSU is and Good Sam and some of the others. And all of those Med-Mal cases are going to have to participate in ADR. I think provide that if both parties agree that it wouldn't be helpful, they can stipulate to waive the procedure. And that's on line 8 of the first page of the dash A9s.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Bruce.
I'm really a fan of alternative dispute resolution. Glad that it applied in Multnomah County, but I'm just wondering whether, if anybody has any assessment of whether there are court costs imposed by this that we should be aware of, or could expand it statewide.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Burdick, in my experience, the ADR that my clients participate is either third-party arbitration or third-party mediation, where the parties are paying the costs of the arbitrator or the mediator. Those individuals are not court staff. The court time comes in when, if you need to, put a settlement on the record, or if you you are arguing with one party or the other over the procedure, although that has not been my experience that those arguments come up very frequently. So I would say that the court costs, obviously there will be some very limited supervision that will need to take place, and maybe in some cases one party will need to be forced to go to arbitration where they just, or you know, some form of ADR where they just refuse to, but I would think that they'd be very minimal.
All right. Senator Ringo, do you want to speak to your amendments?
Sure. First of all, I am not interested in pursuing the A7s, so let's talk about the A10s.
Okay.
The A10s delete about 10 words, and I have drafted this at the request of his attorney, Justin Baxter, who you may remember came and testified, the Asian fellow.
Uh-oh.
Accident.
We're going to be in a recess. Somebody didn't like the order, and I don't know what to say about the intrusion. Okay. Senator Rigo, you were chatting with us about the 7 amendment or the 810?
Yes, the 810 amendment. The question that Mr. Baxter was concerned about was when a court may review the enforceability of an arbitration agreement and look at external circumstances, for example, if the person, let's say they signed it, but they weren't mentally competent to do so, let's say they didn't speak English, let's say there was some sort of fraud that induced their signature, then the court ought to be able to avoid that arbitration clause. And there's several court decisions that apply to this circumstance, and by deleting just a few of the words, Mr. Baxter explained to me that he thought that it would allow for greater court flexibility in voiding arbitration clauses, and that is what the Dash 10 amendments do. Essentially, they take out, and I can show you exactly where on page 3, line 13, they remove the words, and whether a contract containing a valid agreement to arbitrate is enforceable. They remove that decision. They take that decision away from the arbitrator, essentially leaving it with a circuit court. And so that's what the Dash 10 amendments do, is they remove that to allow the circuit court greater flexibility in that regard. And my understanding is the bar does not affect these amendments, and I don't know that anybody does object to the amendment.
All right. Anybody out there objecting to the amendment? Nope. No one there. All right.
Sevens are done.
So, let's see. Do the A6s and the A10s. We have the A11s, correct?
Yes, those are conflict amendments.
Okay. All right, let's talk about the medical malpractice arbitration issue. Committee, any sense for where you want to go with that?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question for our counsel. Which counties right now do have mandatory ADR systems? Every large county does.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rigo, every county, as far as I know, has some ADR procedure. Most counties that don't have the formal Multnomah County procedure, which requires a certification from the parties that they have participated in some form of ADR within 270 days of trial, most counties that don't have something like that, the practice will be that the parties will participate in some form of usually a court settlement conference before trial. It's been my experience as a litigator that 99% of my cases settle, and often some of the cases that I've been most experienced with and have been actually most difficult to settle, interestingly enough, are the construction cases, I think mainly because the amounts are very high that are in issue and there's lots of parties. Often we'll get to right before trial prep, the court will say we're going to a settlement conference whether you like it or not, and we actually end up getting the case settled. So it's my experience that all the counties have some form of ADR, but not as formal as Multnomah. That's definitely the most structured. Washington County, I believe, also has a pretty structured ADR program that's administered by the presiding judge.
Right. It was always handled by Judge Bonebreak, and it was great to tell your clients you're going before Judge Bonebreak.
All right.
In the federal system, ADR is not mandatory. At least in our court, it's optional because you can't get people to come to the table and settle if they don't have a desire to do so. And this makes it mandatory. I understand that all parties to the action agree in writing to waive the dispute. So if one party doesn't want to go to ADR and one party does, you got to go anyway. So I have some concern about that.
If I could, Mr. Chairman,
sure.
Anecdotally, I have a very large construction defect case down in Medford. It's been the subject of quite a bit of press. The plaintiffs did not want to settle at all, and the court ordered them to go to a settlement conference, and as defendants, we all thought, well, this is going to be a big waste of time, but there is something about having a third party talk to you, first letting the parties air their positions to a third party and having a third party evaluate a case that somehow, I think, gives people their ability to at least have some of the exoneration they might have in a court by getting their case in front of a third party, and then also giving them a reality-based or third-party impression of the case. And it really is, even in those situations where one party does not want to go, obviously they always have the ability not to settle, but it seems like for a half day or a day, however long these settlement conferences would take, it would eliminate a lot of cases, and in, especially in the Med-Mal area, these cases often take weeks to try. And so if we spent a day of court time where we might not have before, but we saved 3 weeks of trial time, it seems worthwhile. And, of course, there will be always cases that just aren't going to settle.
Senator Ringo.
You know, some courts have an ADR system where the court, essentially, a judge is acting as a mediator, is supervising a settlement conference. And this, and that way the parties don't have to bear the expense. And this bill doesn't speak to that. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering whether that's a good view, whether by requiring it, and there is no court system, you're going to be requiring both parties, you know, a couple hundred bucks an hour to pay for something that maybe one party thinks is not very useful.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, it is an expense that's usually borne by the parties, but it's been my experience in some of the cases of lesser value that if, for instance, we request a settlement conference, and in Multnomah County, I believe that you can actually request a particular judge. I've often used Sid Galton. I've had good experience with, and there's been, and he's been more than willing to hear those. We usually allot like 3 or 4 hours for it, so a half day, and there's been no expense that I'm aware of. I think that if we did require the court to offer some type of third-party system for this type of ADR, most people would end up just using it because it would obviously save them some amount of money, even if the case is valued quite high. But it would definitely cause fiscal concerns for the court systems, I'm sure. But I have not had any trouble in Multnomah County with getting a judge to mediate or have a settlement conference in the court free of charge to date. Obviously, again, I don't practice medical malpractice. My firm doesn't do medical malpractice either, so that might present a different situation.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think this is really a good direction to be going. You know, even in cases where one party doesn't want to come to the table, these mediators and arbitrators, the training has really built up, especially over the last 10 years in this field. And they're just enormously skilled in getting into a room and taking very hostile people and reframing the discussion. And sometimes in situations like this, the issues are very emotional, and sometimes people just simply need to be heard. And if they can be heard in a situation where that can take place and a reasonable agreement can be reached, that's so much better than the just highly high conflict setting of a trial. It's a very good friend of mine is a mediator, and some of the stories, you know, she tells, of course, always without names, but are just incredible where you start out in a situation and where you're able to end up. There's a lot of creativity and a lot of, you know, just people being heard.
All right.
Sentence.
Well,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Since we are in one section, I would go ahead and I would move on dash 9 amendments with the VADR amendments, the dash 10 amendments, which I've offered, and the dash 11 amendments, which are the conflicts. And there's also the dash 6 amendments that.
Does the bar's clarification amendment center in there?
I guess can we just start with those three amendments and then maybe talk about the A6 amendment?
All right, Senator Ringo moves the adoption.
Mr. Chairman, before you accept the motion, could I suggest that we do these separately
yep,
so that we can have a little piece of discussion?
Well, then I'll go ahead and move the
A9 amendments on the ADR.
All right. Senator Rigo moves the adoption of the A9 amendment. Is there a discussion?
Just one. Has the trial bar been consulted about this amendment when it was drafted?
I've had some general discussions in the hallway with them, and I guess my representation would be they're kind of lukewarm again, kind of not sure if it would really help. And
okay.
I think that's accurate. I think they're lukewarm about it. Frankly, most of the attorneys in practice, I don't know, practice are very sophisticated on the plaintiff and defense, and I think they can gauge their cases when they think ADR, when they do want to go to ADR, and when they don't want to use it.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
To answer Senator Walker's question, I consulted in depth with Rich Lane from OTLA and also with the folks from the hospitals and the doctors on various versions of this amendment. Originally, we were going to require non-binding arbitration. And, another idea was to have a third-party panel of doctors examine the case and declare it does or doesn't have merit. And we all agreed that mediation was the most palatable and acceptable to everybody. And
okay.
Obviously, interestingly enough, in the negotiations to try and get this very amendment, we saw how, at least for me, how mediation in part works, because we brought a bunch of parties, all who had some concern one way or the other, together to agree that while they weren't, you know, they didn't absolutely love the amendment, they were all willing to go with the amendment, and those would be the same parties that would all be brought before a mediator, and the mediator would say, here's how I evaluate the case, you know, and here's what I think is going to happen at trial, and you need to understand those risks if you're going to go forward or settle now.
Senator Berger.
As I understand it, this amendment would also, if for some reason they wanted arbitration, either binding or non-binding, they would be able to pursue that if for some reason.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Further discussion? Any objections to the motion? Any objections? Motion passes. Senator Ringo, you want to move the A-10? Okay, Senator Ringo moves the A-10 amendment, House Bill 2279, discussion.
Mr. Chairman, could we just have another brief explanation about what the purpose of this amendment is?
This is something that was suggested to me by Justin Baxter, the attorney that testified earlier, and it's his opinion that he's been involved in many fights around the issues of when an arbitration clause is enforceable, and there's a concern that a court can say, well, the signature's on the paper, and that's all I'm going to look at. I'm not going to look at the mental competency. I'm not going to look at, say, whether the person speaks English, whether there was fraudulent circumstances surrounding obtaining that signature. And I think that most people would say the court ought to be able to consider some of those circumstances. And it's pretty complex because there are several, I think, a couple of Ninth Circuit cases in play and a couple of Oregon cases in play on this issue. But Mr. Baxter is convinced that by removing a few words on page 3, line 13, we allow the court greater flexibility. Essentially, we're ensuring that that decision is not vested in the arbitrator, it's vested in at the circuit court level. And so we give the circuit court greater flexibility in determining the enforceability of arbitration clauses and taking into account the totality of the circumstances.
So it's a judgment on whether conditions were met to make it valid versus whether what he sees before him is
valid.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add.
Go ahead, Counselor.
I didn't know which amendment Senator Ringo wanted to go with, but now looking at the A-10s, if you read the section that it's amending, essentially on line 13, it's going to pull out the words, and whether a contract containing a valid agreement to arbitrate is enforceable. In other words, the decision of whether an enforceable contract exists is going to rest with the court. And that is more in line with Section 6 as I read it, because the court already has, you'll see court mentioned a few times, it already has purview over most of the questions that get you to whether there should or shouldn't be an arbitration. So I agree with Mr. Baxter's interpretation that having that language on line 13 seems to contradict the rest of Section 6. because then the arbitrator is going to be deciding whether the underlying contract is enforceable. And it seems a little confusing. So I would agree that the Dash 810s probably more reflect that the court should have that authority, and then once it's decided there should be an arbitration, then the arbitrator moves on from there, if that makes sense.
Okay. Any further discussion? All right, any objections to the motion? Our motion then passes. And so which one is next?
Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Well, I'll move to Dash A11.
All right, Senator Ringo moves the Dash A11 amendments, which are the conflict amendments. Any discussion? Is there any objection? No objection. It passes. All right, now we are at, you wanted to speak about the A6 amendments, Senator Ringo?
I am not familiar with these amendments.
Okay.
Probably be helpful to have somebody from the bar come up.
And I see someone making their way. Just identify yourself for the record.
I'm Joyce Patton. I'm with the Oregon State Bar Public Affairs Program.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm with the Office of the State Court Administrator. The Dash A6 amendments were actually work done by Jim Nass from the Court of Appeals and the proponent of the bill and the bar, and that's why it came up. Mr. Nass was here earlier today but had to go to a motion meeting over at the Court of Appeals.
And the intent of the amendment is to do what?
Mr. Chair, the way the A engrossed bill was written, you could take an appeal from a couple of different judgments plus several orders. And the way that it's done now, and the preferred way for appellate procedure, is to wait until there's a judgment in the case before you go up on appeal. So what this does is take those sections from the A engrossed bill, like the several orders were there that you could appeal from, and says you have to wait until they're reduced to judgment and then take it up for appeal from that point. It's a matter of efficiency for the Court of Appeals. It prevents parties from taking several bites from the apple. It makes the process go more smoothly, quicker, and more efficiently.
And if I might add,
sure.
Senator Minnis, what Jim Nass was looking at, in addition, he participated in the enforceability of judgments, Oregon Law Commission's work group, and he was also looking at this and making it consistent with House Bill 2646, which I believe this committee is going to be hearing a little bit later this week. So it was a matter of consistency as well, and the bar has no problems with those amendments. We consider them friendly amendments that help to clarify. The one other aspect of the A6 amendments I would like to bring to your attention, though, Senator Minnis, you had mentioned an inconsistency in the language between Section 3.2 and Section 4.2, and 3.2 says that the Act does not apply to arbitration of the terms or conditions of employment under collective bargaining agreements, and then it appeared to be inconsistent with Section 4.2D that said in part that a labor organization could waive the right to representation by a lawyer in a labor arbitration. We went back, reviewed that language, discussed it with Legislative Counsel's office, and came to the conclusion that you were correct and that it did not appear to be appropriate to have Section 3.2 in there, and so that has been deleted. And that's the other substantive portion of this A6 amendments. The only other part of that is to put in an effective date.
All right, thank you. Yeah, I got a star for being correct. So it's always nice if you're going to ramble on up here and ultimately be proved correct as opposed to being inaccurate. My father used to say it's better to be thought a fool than open your mouth and move all down. All right. So, Senator Ringo, are you happy?
Yes.
Good. Senator Ringo moves the A6 amendment.
I do.
To House Bill 2279. Discussion? Is there any objection? No objection. Motion passed. Senator Burdick, I think we're about ready to move this bill.
Sure.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2279 as amended the Senate floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2279 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a two-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? No objection. Motion passes. And now for our last exciting Senator Ringo, would you carry that?
Yes.
Before we move on, 356, I'm almost positive we had removed the subsequent referral last time we heard this bill, but I'm not sure if we need to be safe to make sure we do that again now that we have the bill back in our committee.
That's a good point. Did we send previously a letter to the Senate President because it was going directly to the floor? So
I don't get those letters into my files. So I do not see one. Correct.
So if it got to the floor, which I believe it did.
Right, it did.
Then I think it's already good.
Okay. Yeah, let's just let it go because unless the Senate President has put another referral on it, I think we'll follow.
Okay.
All right, so 2658.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. If you recall from our last hearing of this bill, 2658 deals with exemption from disclosure for public employees and volunteers' Social Security numbers under the public records law. It was seemed pretty straightforward. We have some amendments before you, which should be the dash A2 amendments, which, to my understanding, would also exempt from disclosure Social Security numbers held by businesses and educational facilities.
All right. And Senator Walker, these are yours, I understand.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could speak to those.
Sure.
At the hearing that we had previously on this bill on May 21st, I became concerned that we were making Social Security numbers available in any circumstance outside of those circumstances required by law. So I went down to see Greg Chamoff, Legislative Counsel, and I said, can we draft an amendment that won't change the world as we know it, but rein in the use of private companies, Oregon University System, those sorts of people from disclosing Social Security numbers. And this is the amendment that we came up with, and I understand that some people do feel we have changed the world as we know it with some parts of this, and I guess we'll just have that discussion. But let me just say that I brought this up to the University of Oregon several years ago when I first got elected because some students were concerned about it. My own children were concerned about it. And I was told at the time that it's too expensive to change it out. So the University of Oregon has for many years, as I suspect other universities in the system, used Social Security numbers as ID numbers. I have with me today my University of Oregon identification card from 1975. I would have had the 74 one, but I got married and had to change my name. And on the front of it is embossed my Social Security number. I have with me today my daughter's University of Oregon ID card. She graduated in the fall. My son has one, too. And on the front of it is her Social Security number. Now, you're cautioned over and over and over again that you shouldn't carry your Social Security card in your wallet, because your wallet could be stolen and someone would have your Social Security number. But you've got this friggin' ID card, and I'm just so angry about it, and it's got your Social Security number on it, and someone would said, well, but how do they know that's your Social Security number? You'd have to be an idiot not to know that was the Social Security number. Additionally, I asked my daughter to testify, but she gets so intimidated with the way I cross-examine witnesses. So she has related information to me. She says when she goes to class, when she did go to class that required attendance, the instructor would give them a notepad such as this and say, write down your name and Social Security number. Bless you. And so she would write her name and her Social Security number on the pad. It would be passed around the room, and everyone else would write their name and their Social Security number. So now everyone
sees that as it goes around the room. Additionally, when grades are posted at the university, a Social Security number is listed on the door outside the room of the professor's office. They're supposed to only use the last four digits of the Social Security number, but they often use the entire Social Security number. And as my daughter said, this University of Oregon ID card she uses everywhere. She uses to get into the movies, to go to games, and everybody sees that number on the front. Also, when you get on Duck Web, your Social Security number is your password, and then you have another PIN number. So we've heard testimony in this committee that identity theft, we're number seven in the country for identity theft in Oregon. We treat Social Security numbers just so laissez-faire in the state that it's just amazing that we're not number one in the country. So my issue, and insurance companies use Social Security numbers generally as ID card, as ID numbers. My husband is insured through Pacific Source, but they no longer use ID card, your Social Security number. They use another ID number, and they switched to that a couple of years ago. Don't look at her Social Security number. You can look at her. She's blonde then. PEB, if you are covered under PEB, your Social Security number is your ID number. So everywhere you go, your Social Security number is available to the world. So now that you've all heard my ranting and raving about it, I just think we need to rein this practice in. This amendment says that except as otherwise provided or required by law, you can use the Social Security number. The relating clause on the bill was related to disclosure, so I couldn't prohibit the use of the Social Security number by the university system, but we figured that if they can't disclose it, they can't use it. So I'm open and prepared to hear why we should continue to keep using Social Security numbers as ID numbers. And that's the whole purpose of the amendment, Mr. Chair. And the underlying bill is a good bill. I don't want to hold it up, but I sure as heck want to have this discussion.
All right. Excellent. Senator Ringo.
Maybe I missed this, just a question, though. These amendments say the state institution may not disclose, and by that, you think that would prohibit them from using it on the ID card?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ringo, in my discussion with Greg Chamoff, that's how we could reason that we could prohibit the use of the, because of the relating clause.
Okay.
If you can't disclose it, you sure can't use it.
Right.
And this is disclosure.
Okay, that is disclosure.
This is disclosure.
Okay.
Yeah, you betcha. That's disclosure.
Okay.
All right. We don't have a sign-up sheet, so interested parties that want to chat about this?
Oh, and Mr. Chair, while the university system is coming forward, well, I'll just wait when they come up and they testify.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, just for context purposes, the last time we heard this bill, I believe the day before, there was an article in the paper about Comcast, if you recall,
yes,
disclosing Social Security numbers to marketers.
Here's what you can.
All right, just introduce yourself for the record and tell us what you want to tell us.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Zavala, Associate Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System. With me today is David McDonald, who is Director of Enrollment Services. I will let David talk about some of our primary concerns with regard to the use of Social Security numbers as student identifier numbers in areas such as research and data sharing with other federal and state agencies. I would like to just address some of Senator Walker's concerns regarding the phasing out of the use of Social Security numbers in classrooms and student body cards. Currently, new students who are enrolled in our universities are issued an alternative number. We are not using Social Security numbers any longer for student identification numbers for new students. Current students who are enrolled and have been enrolled for the past several years are, in fact, still using utilizing their Social Security numbers for identification numbers. However, all of our campuses are either in the process of phasing that out and retooling and using alternative numbers. And in fact, some of our campuses have totally eliminated that practice. Western Oregon University, for example, has reissued student identification cards last July, a year ago, using an alternative number or alternative numbers. Eastern Oregon University does not use Social Security numbers. PSU, OSU, and U of O, our largest universities, are in the process of phasing that out. They're replacing those numbers. It is a cost factor, Mr. Chairman, and we anticipate that 100 to 200 students are circulated through that process a month at the University of Oregon. That's the information I received yesterday. So we are in the process. It's just a time factor and a cost factor, and we are in the process of doing so. We have given you some testimony. I'm going to turn it over to David, and he will talk to you about the use of Social Security numbers for research.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record again, Dave McDonald, Director of Enrollment Student Services, the Chancellor's Office. Before I go into testimony, I'd like to add to Senator Walker that any student at the University of Oregon today who wishes to get a new ID card can go in free of charge and have one issued. And all ID cards issued now are without the Social Security number as the default. So you could not today get an ID card issued with a Social Security number on it. That is part of the replacement process. And again, students can go in free of charge and get new cards issued at their choice or at their leisure. Now going directly from my testimony, which I am prepared to provide, the Oregon University System has concerns regarding the A2 amendments to House Bill 2658. Our concerns are centered upon the unintended but potentially adverse impact that these amendments would have on our ability to conduct policy research in areas of central concern such as student success, financial aid, and access to college. Oftentimes, these responses or these studies are in response to requests made by this body, by our own board, by the U.S. Department of Education, as well as the Chancellor's Office in our ongoing efforts to be accountable for our actions and make sure that our behavior and our activities are benefiting students to the maximum possible. Unfortunately, Social Security number is the only way in which we can accurately identify all of the students. There is no other unique characteristic about students that we can use to accurately match records from different databases. There are a number of Smiths in the world. There are a number of Jones in the world. When students enroll in college, they may go under the first name of Jonathan when they first enroll, but somewhere along the line change to John. At some point in time, they may use their middle initial. At some point in time, they may not. All these things will disrupt our ability to do record matches based on names, because every time a student changes their name, we now have a disjunction in terms of databases, so we have inaccurate data in terms of being able to do any kind of longitudinal or meaningful studies that help us direct our own activities. It's important to note that we do share the SSNs. We fully admit to that, but we share it without personal identification, so we send across a number of 9-digit numbers to our partners, such as the Oregon Student Assistance Commission and their state agency, Oregon Community Colleges, U.S. Department of Education for financial aid purposes and such, so that we can do studies. Again, we take every effort to encode the data and to make sure that it is not linked to a particular individual. So even if the SSNs were found, you would not know that this particular number went to this person. We do not transfer the same pieces in the same documents so that we can have some security. Again, we make sure that when we do transmit it, they are to authorized and legitimate agencies, and we do not give them to private vendors. Students at the OUS campuses, all 7 campuses, are informed upon an application, which all students must do to take courses, that they can have, and this is a practice we've had for many years, they can have an alternative number issued. It is part of the application process. Further, they can have their SSN pulled from our database so that we cannot use it for any studies. This is at the student's option at any point in time during their enrollment. So they have full control over what information is provided, what information is used by us internally and such. To date, or currently of our 70,000 students enrolled, 4,000 have requested their SSNs not be used for any studies whatsoever. So that's 4,000 students that we do not have any ability to track. We cannot tell you how they did from a community college upon transfer to OUS. We cannot tell you about how financial aid may or may not have affected them. We cannot determine how their transfer or taking a course from other institutions may have affected their time to degree. And all these things are no longer possible for that group of students. And we certainly honor that request. We look forward to working with the sponsor of this amendment to do what we can to make sure that SSNs are properly used, that they are safeguarded so that we don't have unauthorized or inappropriate disclosures of their uses. In terms of professors utilizing SSNs inappropriately, Senator Walker, they are using them inappropriately, and they should not be part of any class information that is either collected or provided or distributed. Our faculty members are oftentimes reminded, and I will make sure that we do a more diligent job of reminding all of our faculty members upon the appropriate use of SSNs, which basically in a course means only for grade assignments. They should not be part of any rosters, any part of grade listings, or any kind of sign-in sheets. And we will make every effort to make sure our faculty are reminded of a policy which they already know. It reminds me of a speed limit. We all know the speed limit is 65 miles an hour on the freeway in most places, but unfortunately people do exceed that. It isn't because the law is not well known, it's not because the law is not established, it's because people inadvertently sometimes do not follow it. We will make a very diligent effort, and I'll be glad to work with you, Senator Walker, and members of the committee, to make sure that we take every step possible to remove any inappropriate use of an SSN. However, the way this bill is drafted, the removal of the SSN from our research would greatly cripple our ability to answer key questions which this body and other bodies have asked us to answer on a regular basis. Thank you.
Well, I got a question for you. The A2 amendment says that the State Institute of Higher Education may not disclose without the student's consent. So, assumedly, you have the student's consent, and therefore the amendment would allow you to do what you're currently doing.
Chairman, it's the line above that says except otherwise required by law. The requirements by law are very, very narrow in terms of disclosure of SSN. They are basically to the IRS to confirm that a student is enrolled so that they can claim their lifelong tax credits that were enacted in 1999, HOPE credits, or to the U.S. Department of Education for financial aid. Those are the only two standing requirements for the utilization of Social Security numbers by higher education.
Well, but understand, but then it goes on to say a state institution of higher education may not disclose without the student's consent, which means that you can disclose it if the student consents. And if you have the consent of the student, then I don't see what the problem is.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is a question in our minds, too. And I had asked for a chance to talk that through and to work that out and find out what really that will mean for us. If a student, when a student applies or applies for admission at an institution, they are given in their admission packet. They also do sign, in some cases, in the back of David's testimony, there's an excerpt from the Southern Oregon University's admissions policy that says that the student, by signing this, will authorize SOU and the Oregon University system to use a Social Security number for tracking. So that is what we would consider a consent to use that information. It's just leaving it, it's quite broad in our concern. It's quite broad, and it will leave some question as to when we can use it, when a student actually has consented or has asked for that information to be withheld, and are we violating it? And it's just a concern for us, okay. Senator.
All right. Any other questions, Senator Ringo?
Thank you. I was curious about your point about student may request another number. Could you expand on that, please?
Certainly. Chairman and Senator Ringo, currently our computer systems are able to generate a random number for any student. So as a student, we'll use the University of Oregon as an example. If a student were to want to have their new ID card issued, sometimes for a better picture, sometimes for a lost card, or just to have a new number, they could simply go to our office in the Urban Memorial Union and have a new card issued. A randomly generated 9-digit number would be assigned to that student to take the place of an SSN.
And that 9-digit number essentially acts like their student ID number, and you can use that number for tracking all these things you just described.
Senator Ringo, we could use that internally, correct, for internal work, but if we were to work with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to link financial aid data they have on students, or if a student were to transfer to another institution, either to us or from us, the SSN would be the only link that we could use, because each institution would assign its own unique number.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to a name change every time the student changed schools.
Right. My experience was to have a student ID number that was a different from the Social Security number. That student ID number was on the card. And it seems to me that would address some of Senator Walker's concerns, and you could easily have your cross-reference of the student ID number to the Social Security number so you could still process the data in all the ways that you want to.
Senator Ringo, that is the process in which the new cards are being issued. And so at Western Oregon University, for instance, all students have that particular connection of a 9-digit random number on their ID card and then an SSN in a database that's out of public access.
And that's where, at Western?
That's at Western, and all of our other campuses are moving in that same direction.
I see.
All right. Other questions or comments? There are none. There are some other folks that want to speak. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, excuse me. For the record, Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And we share some of the same concerns from the university system regarding the use of Social Security numbers that we currently use for various research purposes to be able to track students in the community college system. We're concerned that the amendments as drafted, because it's not entirely clear what disclosure would mean, would limit our school's ability to use those Social Security numbers for a variety of different research purposes, both with financial aid for our students that transfer to the university system to be able to track how our students perform when they reach the university system, and also to track against unemployment records to see if our students are employed after they graduate from the community colleges. Because of those reasons, we are very concerned about this legislation. I'd like to turn it over to Cam Price-Brawley, the Commissioner for Community Colleges, who can talk in more detail about some of the specific research that's currently being done.
All right. Go ahead.
For the record, Cam Price-Brawley, Commissioner of Community Colleges. I think it has been laid out quite adequately the concerns that we have around the word disclosure and what it means. All students at the community college are asked to sign and disclose and allow the use of their Social Security number for research and reporting purposes. About a decade ago, when the workforce partners, the Department of Education, community colleges, the department, the employment department, were building a integrated data system, we asked the Attorney General, could we share through disclosure and through sign-offs, Social Security numbers, so that we could do longitudinal tracking of how students who were served or citizens of the state were served by the workforce system, how well they did or didn't do after they left training or other job search opportunities. We received a very long and lengthy Attorney General's opinion about disclosure, and we have adopted, because of that opinion, a very detailed disclosure statement that students must sign. We must identify exactly and in great detail how and for what purpose the Social Security number will be used. Don't hear me say that I think that's a bad idea. I just think when the amendment as drafted says may not disclose, I think we need to be careful that we ask students to consent, and we must tell them exactly what it is they are consenting to, which does, I think, place some additional burden on the departments to ensure that today we may know that we want these three research projects, and we may come to the legislative session and you may say, and now we want X, Y, and Z, and so we must go back and have the students re-sign. At least this is our interpretation of the Attorney General's disclosure requirements around the privacy and the use of the Social Security number. And we just have been very clear that we are collecting it for very particular purposes. I think it would, as drafted now, place a burden on the agencies. And this is for internal use, as the university system testified. We don't sell this information to vendors. We use it to track our own success, the student success, and I think that
right.
Covered it.
Good question.
Yes.
Senator Farioli and then Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In a situation where an identity theft occurs and it's discovered that an agency, either in the university system or elsewhere, is either complicit or careless, what's the potential for a liability to the institution for an identity theft that harms an individual?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I'm unable to answer your question.
Possibly I could.
Flocks of people run into the program.
I don't have specific experience, but typically I would assume that the university system as part of the state would have sovereign immunity. Therefore, there might have a tort claim process, and you'd have to file a tort claim notice under the Tort Claim Act within 180 days of learning of the damage. Then the university would accept that and either say, no, we're not paying, or yes, let's try and settle. If they don't, then you can bring an action, but you would still obviously have the burden of overcoming the sovereign immunity hurdle. Even in that situation. So I am not sure if there would be liability against a university.
Chairman, if I may, for the record again, Dave McDonald, Director of Enrollment Services, OUS. Under federal law, as indicated by the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, otherwise known as FERPA, U.S. Department of Education is charged with compliance of proper use and non-disclosure of SSNs. A campus, whether it be a community college or a four-year university, public or private, that failed to safeguard Social Security numbers would be subject to fine by the U.S. Department of Education, withholding the Title I, which is financial aid dollars and other punitive damages that are very serious. So the federal government is currently in a position to punish institutions that do not properly safeguard SSNs, and they do have an entire Office of Compliance that does just that.
Mr. Chairman, that really did not get to the issue of liability for tort or for damages.
Right.
It tells me about the federal effort to comply and to get compliance, but I'm just specifically curious about the potential liability for an institution that has someone in the institution that's either complicit. And, you know, from time to time there are these cases. There was one recently with a lending institution where identity theft was institutionalized by some of the employees and, you know, doing entrepreneurial business on the side. And then every once in a while there's a break in a DMV office and a whole slew of licenses and blanks disappear. And I'm just curious to know, has anybody ever connected the liability of the institutions that keep this information on a tort basis? Sooner or later, that's going to happen. As long as you keep publishing information that can be used to steal identities, sooner or later people are going to figure out that you have liability for publishing that information. And I just wonder when the university system is going to tumble to the fact that they're actually setting themselves up for a problem.
Okay. And I think with respect to the university systems, community colleges, I think counsel's advice with respect to tort claims and others and sovereign issues would apply, but then you get to the business side of this amendment, it may change. There may be more liability on the business.
So and Mr. Chairman, I believe you're absolutely right, and I think that counsel's right, but I also think that if there's a compelling case made for a pattern of negligence, knowing that identity theft is a relatively new and increasing crime, that those tort liabilities those immunities won't stand out. Somebody's going to breach that wall, and universities are going to find themselves holding a significant liability problem because they published this information.
All right, Senator Walker and then Senator Burnett.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Crowley and Ms. Higginson, could you tell me, does the community college system use Social Security numbers as student ID numbers?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't currently have that information, but we could certainly ask our community colleges. That decision will be made on a community college by community college basis, since each of them are locally governed. I don't currently have information as to whether they use them, but I can certainly check into that for you.
Well, I think that's pretty critical because I know that Sarah had a student body card with Lane Community College when she was there in the flight program, and I can't remember. I didn't ask her that question. And her backpack was stolen out of her car, and so then we had to put a hold on her account at Lane Community College so that no one went in and charged anything, and it became a big hassle. But that's a big concern, as you heard this morning, that if you do use those Social Security numbers as ID numbers and they're printed on the card. So I'd really like an answer to that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, I might be able to add a little. I was able to reach several colleges this morning regarding the use of Social Security number, and they use a synonym or a pseudonym, a fake ID number, and they require all faculty, staff, and administrators to participate in FERPA training, and they all must sign that they understand the restrictions around the disclosure or use of a Social Security number, and that's why they use the synonym. They actively...
What are you talking about? Are you talking about a number that's not a Social Security number?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, yes. Just as the university system discussed, just a 9-digit number that's made up, that's used, that connects back to the student internally.
And that's their ID number.
Right. That's their ID number.
But it's key to the Social Security number, if I understood correctly, the previous testimony. All right. There are a few other people out there. We've got about 5 minutes or so, and I can kind of get some other folks on, so get at least the issues presented to the committee. Folks from the business community, I assume.
You can do that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis, today representing the Oregon Collectors Association, Mortgage Lenders Association, and TransUnion. I appreciate Senator Walker's concerns and her frustrations. This is a difficult area where we, as a matter of policy, I think, try to balance individuals' right to privacy with legitimate businesses' ability to engage in commerce. Section 7 creates huge problems for the business community, particularly credit and collections industry. And unfortunately, I guess, on a national basis, Social Security numbers are used by everyone in the credit and collections industry. And without that identifying piece, would be very, very difficult to sort out whose debt it is when you have many, many individuals with the same names. It would just create huge problems and confusion and increase errors in credit reporting companies' databases, and perhaps in cases of identity theft even make it more difficult to sort out what was what after the action had occurred. Beyond those general comments, I would just say I think there are some technical problems that I would see with the amendments. This creates a new right of private action by a student or a consumer who was aggrieved. And in the case of the students, this would be an action against a state body. And I'm not sure how this new action would conflict with the Tort Claims Act, which is another kind of claim. So, and the venue for this action appears to be where the student resides, whether he is still in school or not. The student would be the plaintiff. That would be in conflict with the rules of civil procedure and case law, which generally, I think, Senator Ringo, you could help, requires an action to be brought where the defendant lives or where the claim arose. And I think this would be probably the only exception to that, and again would be in conflict with the Tort Claims Act. Section 7, sub 2 talks about except as otherwise required by law, not allowed by law. And so unless there were a specific statute that required a business to disclose a Social Security number, they would simply not be able to do that. I think that might include even giving a Social Security number of an individual to a law enforcement agency or some other state agency where it was not specifically required by law, but under present law is allowed. There is a question also with in terms of this right of private action as to what the statute of limitations would be, whether it would be a contract action with a 6-year statute or a tort action which would require a 2-year statute of limitations. These are just some of the things that jumped out at me that I think would need to be addressed if this were to move forward. So thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Senator Ringo, you want to jump in
I can understand why the quite collectors need social security numbers, but it seems to me that you're not going to even be involved in this until, let's say, a student's account is turned over to you for collection. And I mean, is that the context?
Now, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringel, I'm sorry. Section 7, you've been discussing the student portion. Section 7 of this bill prohibits a business from disclosing a social security number to anybody without the consumer's permission.
I was more focused on
a business were to assign a debt to a collection agency, they couldn't give them the social security number. And if they didn't pay a debt and they wanted to report it to a credit reporting company, they wouldn't be allowed to include the social security number.
Okay. Thank you. All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Powell representing Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon and State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman and members, the last part of the amendment that's been referred to that deals with all businesses would affect the use of Social Security numbers. In the case of health insurers, we would need a delayed effective date for the provisions of an act like that. I think in California, insurers are moving away from Social Security numbers for ID numbers in a 4 or 5 year phase-out period. It is very difficult given the place that a company might be with their ID system in terms of either switching over or at the end of the utilization period, and they would want to phase in a transition if they're going to get a new system to that new system, and that's the case at Regions right now. It's undergoing a massive change in their IT system. So it would take more than just till this January to accomplish this goal. In terms of life insurance, Mr. Chairman, I'll have to do some research in terms of those kinds of benefits along with annuities and other kinds of insurance products. And how the Social Security number might be used in reporting to the IRS, to other agencies of government. So I'll do some research on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Powell, those would be required under law to report those. And then let me get back to Blue Cross Blue Shield. You're one of the largest insurers in Oregon. Pacific Source probably doesn't even come close to you, though they're large. They've switched over already. What's your problem? Why haven't you switched? And I understand you need time to do that, but do you need a law to tell you to stop using a Social Security number as an ID number?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, no, and I do believe they are processing the transition to a non-Social Security base number.
You believe that they're doing that here in Oregon now? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis, representing Associated Oregon Industries and the Retail Association. I have a couple points that I'd like to make that we would need some additional clarification and to get any level of comfort with this legislation, the section related to business information. Senator Walker just brought up an interesting point about something being required by law. There's a requirement of law type of language, and then there's allowed by law type of language. And the reaction I've gotten from, especially from national companies who have responded to me on this amendment, have some very big concerns because the provision of required by law they actually see is very small, a very small window. Allowed by law, however, is a much larger window and a much more important window to them. And they gave me a variety of examples. In the employer-employee relationship, there might be a need for a background check. Because of issues like identity theft, many of our retailers do background checks now, people who would be taking credit cards or handling credit information. They do background checks to make sure they haven't been involved with larceny or other crimes related to identity theft. Police often come into our places of employment, especially when there has been identity theft. A retail establishment is a better example. Trying to look into information related to the Social Security numbers that might have been stolen by either an internal employee or might have been a customer's information that might have been subject to identity theft. The So the one point that has come up, I think, by many of the people up here today, is whether we like it or not, the Social Security number is a unique identifier. There isn't anything nationally to take its place. And that is what we struggle with. We don't support identity theft. We often pay the price of identity theft as retailers and consumers. One of the bigger concepts we have out there is when you're trying to do things like background checks, what is going to take its place? And I think many of you have heard probably about biometrics and the coming of age of biometrics. I, at 5 in the morning, cannot get into my health club without giving a hand scan. And that's how I get into my club. That's my unique identifier. But as time goes on, it's going to be something like that that replaces the Social Security Act. Going back to a statement I made earlier, when we talk about what is allowed by law and what is required by law, on the phone with some counsel from Chicago this morning, it's my understanding, their understanding, and they were like very leery about this, that the Patriot Act that has just been passed is divided into two different portions of type of things that are required by law and things that are allowed by law that, once again, might require the use of a Social Security number. And they could not go into any depth about that because it is so new, but they were kind of struggling with that as well. There are also very core issues to why businesses use the Social Security number. Employee benefits. We have a variety of employee benefits that employers often offer to their employees, and those benefits are often internally handled on a Social Security card or Social Security number basis. So your 401k, your health care, any other type of retirement benefit, those are all networked. And again, that might be something that the person allows to be disclosed, consents to be disclosed. But still, that was a core issue that many of the people on the phone this morning were discussing. And finally, as another core issue, as representing with my retail hat on, and that's the consumer. And it is impossible for, I shouldn't say it's impossible, it is very hard to offer terms of credit to our consumers if we don't have a unique identifier that we can do a credit check on, so that we know that this is Julie Brandis, who lives in Corvallis, Oregon, whose Social Security number is this, and she is employed by AOI. It is the Social Security number that, again, is the unique identifier. And you'll see that employers and people who provide services to consumers are beginning to ask for multiple forms of identification. But still, because they need to go to the credit bureaus, they need that Social Security number. And an example, to go to the clinic that I go to, the other day they wouldn't see me because I could not produce personal identification with a picture of myself on it. I had my health card, I had my Social Security number, but I didn't have a picture ID to combine all three. So eventually they took my Costco card because I was running a fever and they felt sorry for me. On the PEB issue that Senator Walker brought up earlier, from what I understand, there is an opt-out clause, and a very small percentage of people do opt out of using their Social Security card number, but I am under the understanding of that, that does occur. I know more than I've ever wanted to know about ID theft because in the last 5 years, my husband and I have had some type our identification tapped at least three times. When I look both at a personal level and a professional level at legislation like this, this is not the solution to identity theft, unfortunately. At one point when our identity was stolen, it was an internal employee at some company that had a Social Security number of ours that provides a service to AOI. It was, we don't know which one, but somehow five or six people at AOI had their identity stolen. What was so important about that is having a Social Security number allowed the Portland police to do a variety of checks very quickly on who I really was, and to put a stop to the crime before they even made contact with me, because they couldn't find me because I was on maternity leave, and that's another issue, but it wasn't very hard to find me. But anyway, those are types of issues that Social Security number comes into play and is very important for the business community.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I listened intently, and I made some notes, of course, but I'm surprised that you bring up this issue about credit checks and credit applications, because if you want credit, you're giving permission to use your Social Security number to get that. So I'm not tracking that one. And I recall about 5 years ago, I was making a debit card purchase at a store in the mall, and she said, could I have your Social Security number? And I said, like hell, you're going to get my Social Security number. I was really, I did. And I said, she looked at me very startled, and I said, you have no reason to ask for my Social Security number, and if I can't make the purchase without giving it to you, then I don't need this item. And she backed down. But I don't understand why a clerk in a store would want my Social Security number. So I'm just a little confused about the credit applications. I don't know. The Patriot Act is the most ridiculous thing we've ever passed in this nation, and it has a lot of problems, as we have seen, detaining people who shouldn't be detained, and that's an issue at the federal level. But some of the issues that you talked about, people would be giving permission to use it. And your distinction between allowed by law and required by law, I like that one. I like that distinction, and I'd like to talk more about that. Because I think that would solve some of your concerns.
All right. We are 10 minutes over now. I think we've heard a myriad of comments regarding the amendment. Senator Walker, we'll chat. Good afternoon.
So do we all get to see your picture from
1970? Yeah, 1975. I was 19.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of, one of the things you do is.